Hello and welcome to Reverend Testimony, brought to you by Netroots Radio, the political podcast by and for millennial and Gen Xer types. From a left-wing perspective, it is Saturday, September 30th, 2017. I am back from my European vacation, which is very eventful. Got in a fight and an Oktoberfest, and then went to Italy and was involved in this caper with like these gangster types, and wound up driving a car into a fountain. Oh, wait a minute. No, that's National Lampoon's European Vacation. So I confuse them sometimes.
Yeah.
Mine was less eventful than that, but I'm back. Thank you for Rachel and Dana for filling in while I was gone, bringing you all the good stuff. Speaking of good stuff, I wish we had more to report on, but
nothing's really happened this week.
Yeah.
I guess talk about the weather.
We'll talk about the weather or the consequences of the weather in certain places and our president's reaction to it, which has reached new depths today, which it feels like we say every week, but
this is particularly,
this is great. We've gone beyond scraping the bottom of the barrel, and we've taken a pickaxe to the bottom of the barrel, and we're now like,
and we're like 20 feet below ground looking up at the shards of the barrel from a year ago and going, oh, that was not the bottom.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't at all. So I don't know what you want to start with, but
I think we should start with Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
Unless you've been living under a rock, you understand that there's been hurricanes. Yeah.
Puerto Rico got devastated by Hurricane Maria.
Yeah.
Completely devastated. Took a direct hit. Almost power to almost the entire island got wiped out. Most of their infrastructure got completely wiped out. The federal response was slow. Some of that is just the nature of Puerto Rico being an island. Some of that is just ineptitude from our commander in chief and apathy. And
it's been 11 days.
Yeah.
And power to most of the island has not been restored. I have a
friend, only like 5% restored to this point.
Yeah. I have a friend who is Puerto Rican, and she has a lot of family in Puerto Rico, and I don't know her that well, but just via Facebook, she's talking a lot about how, I think as of yesterday, she has still not heard if her family is okay. Her husband's family is also from Puerto Rico. He finally heard from them, I think, on Thursday.
Yeah.
And then they're fine, but there's no power for many, many days. They didn't have any cell phone, internet communication. They had one radio station playing,
right?
Which most people couldn't access.
Well, let's explain this too, right? Puerto Rico, like most places in the world now, is most people mostly have cell phones. There aren't a lot of landlines left.
Right.
Landlines typically, after a hurricane, do a little better because they're underground, but the few landlines that are left are probably completely swamped, and you probably can't get through to or from a landline typically.
And who has a landline?
Well, right. And then as far as the cell towers go, even if the cell tower survived, they still need power.
Yeah.
So without power, they're useless.
And a lot of them did not survive.
No.
And, I mean, it's absolute devastation. Like, we're talking thousands of people are going to die if they don't do something quickly.
I'm going to get to that. The public health crises that are emerging.
Yes.
Out of the lack of response or poor response or whatever you want to call it. But the big news this morning is that the mayor of Puerto Rico basically said either last night or early this morning, look, we need more help from the federal government. They're not doing enough.
Right. She was saying like some deputy of some department, whatever, FEMA, I guess, came out and said yesterday, like, you know, was talking about the response, and then like, this is such a great story how we're all working together. And the mayor came out and she was like, what great story is this? People are dying. People are starving. People are thirsty. People don't have power. There's no great story to be told here. And we need help. Or I'm like desperately asking you for help. Whatever you can do, please help us. And then our president, who is golfing in Bedminster, New Jersey,
literally,
Had some fucking choice things to say. What did he say?
Well, he essentially said, the mayor of Puerto Rico is now being nasty to me. And that's a direct quote, pretty much.
The Democrats have told her she must be nasty to Trump, something like that.
Right. He's talking about himself in third person.
Yeah.
and the people of Puerto Rico are depending on handouts from the federal government instead of working as a community.
Yeah, why do they want everything to be done for themselves? This should be a community effort.
Yeah, it's like the
implying that
Breitbart's comment section came to life and became president.
Out of the president's
which shouldn't surprise
tiny
us.
Hands.
But in the midst of an actual humanitarian crisis involving American citizens, which again, a lot of people don't understand that Puerto Ricans are American citizens. I bet a lot of Americans didn't or still don't know that today.
They absolutely are.
Yeah, they literally are. It's not just saying, oh, in spirit. Like, no, they're American.
They're literal American citizens.
They can't vote in the presidential election. They can vote in primaries.
They don't have congressional representation, which is a problem.
Which is a problem,
if you're a politics nerd, you knew that they were American citizens because this is the shit we argue about in addition to Washington,
D.C.
Well,
if you remember anything from your 7th grade civics class, probably.
Yeah.
But geography,
like, you know,
yeah.
Yeah, taxation without representation and all of that. Like, we always bitch about Puerto Rico and D.C. Because these are American citizens.
And they've been fighting for statehood for a long time, and there's been resistance to that in Congress.
For reasons I don't understand.
Well, for reasons I think we do understand.
Right.
All too well.
Right.
This
but
is
anyway.
A majority Spanish-speaking population.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, they're American citizens. This is, people have been calling it Trump's Katrina. I would say it's worse than that. Which is hard to say because I have people that were directly affected by Katrina in my life, but I think they would agree that.
Well, let me tell you why I think it's worse. I think it's worse because George W. Bush, he made the mistake of being inept, of putting cronies in charge of important things like FEMA. And
Brownie, if you're
right. Yeah, yeah. But he expressed genuine regret after things went wrong, and he still does to this day.
And he certainly, I mean, yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I mean, he sucked for being in that position. He sucked for not taking these departments seriously, probably on this very dogmatic, stupid Republican idea that, well, you know, government sucks anyway, so who cares? Just put your friend in charge.
Well, it was a city full of brown people, and that didn't matter as much.
That was probably part of it, maybe subconsciously. But I think in retrospect...
No, I think absolutely that was part of it.
Probably. But you know what? In retrospect, I genuinely think when he says, I regret the way I handled it, that he believes that.
Oh, I do too. I do too, 100%. I just think the reason that it was handled so poorly and inefficiently and militarily, sort of like the federal response to the residents was much less of we're here to help you and save you as it was, you know, you might be dangerous.
Right.
Don't cross that bridge. We're going to hold guns and shoot you. Like, it was a crazy time.
And I don't think George W. Bush was totally indifferent to the suffering. I just don't think he ever got into office to be a public servant. And that's what happens. Now, with Trump, it's way worse because A, he doesn't care, and B, he's not going to regret anything.
And we don't have a functional government. At least under W, we were fully staffed federal government.
Yeah.
We don't have, the government isn't staffed. The government is not functional.
Oh, what would you give now to have a Condoleezza Rice and a Colin Powell?
Oh my God.
Some of these people, or a Richard Painter, or some actual competent politicians, despite some
competent
of the horrible things
servants.
They did to get us into wars and whatnot.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
what would you give?
Oh my God. Yeah. It's, we always knew there would be something that would happen, right?
Yeah.
In the early days of this presidency, and we were worried about it. We didn't know if it was going to be some virus or epidemic or, you know,
that
terrorist
stuff
attack
could still be coming.
Or whatever. But what we've come upon is absolute natural disaster, devastation.
Well, I'm gonna get to all that and wind back to election night and why more than ever the Jill Stein, Bernie, I'm not going to vote people are, we do need to slap you.
Yes.
So yes, we're threatening violence because we're so fed up.
If not
literally, then as figuratively walking the line of literally as you could possibly get. Yeah. They've stayed away from us. They don't talk to us much anymore. And I understand why, because there is no defense anymore for what their part in bringing this about. And I guess I'll get to it right now, unless I'm cutting you off and you have some thoughts.
Go ahead.
Here's the thing, guys. Election night and in the early days after, we said a lot of things that seemed to fall on really deaf ears.
We were called hyperbolic. We were called hysterical. We were called all kinds of things.
Well, we saw the bigger picture, right?
Yes.
Like, government, like, okay, elections are not just about the personality contest and the horse race and the way you feel on election night and the way you feel when you pull the lever, which Americans have decided is the number one
most important thing.
Like, I want to feel something when I pull this lever, and I want to have fun on election night. And in a personality contest of some bizarre variety, which makes it even more inexplicable how this guy became president. But the point is, we were very, very scared for a lot of people, not ourselves, because we knew that it was inevitable that there's going to be natural disasters, because natural disasters happen all the time. There's perhaps going to be a pandemic, because those happen from time to time. There could be an international crisis, because
which we're working our way up to.
There could be terrorism, because terrorism doesn't stop no matter who's president.
Yep.
And we knew that we had someone in office and who was very likely to surround themselves with people who, A, don't care, don't have any inclination towards public service in any way, shape, or form, period. And
don't know anything.
And don't know anything. So we knew, and we said, and we was met on deaf ears, like, to all the Jill Stein people and the I didn't vote people and I voted for
Gary
Trump
Johnson.
Out of spite people. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, when these things happen, the most vulnerable people, and maybe it won't be me and you, or it could be me and you, but really the most vulnerable people are going to be put in situations that are lethally dangerous.
That's right.
Because that's the way the world works. The world is a dangerous, scary place, and we're mere mortals, and acts of God, natural disasters, and terrorism and war affects people. And though, no matter who's in charge, the best president in the world, those things are going to kill people. Without smart, competent, caring leadership, it can be exponentially worse.
Yes.
And we were very scared. And we said, it's not going to take long. Within the first year, something bad is going to happen and people are going to die as a result.
Yes.
Because we have elected a man to president who is not fit to hold the job. And now we are seeing that firsthand. And all the people who played a role in this, because of their petty, butthurt issues with the DNC or the emails or whatever the fuck it was, own a piece of this and can deny it as much as they want, but they do. And this is why we are unabashedly, tirelessly frustrated with you, and we'll beat it into your heads until you understand the responsibility that comes with participating in a democracy and the way you vote.
That's right.
It matters.
It does. It does. It's, and like you said, it's not just the guy who gets elected, because it's not like we have a government infrastructure that just stays put no matter who this isn't a figurehead. He's not the king. He's an actual head of government. And that means he gets to appoint people to all the other pieces of the federal government and
all the
executive branch.
Important bureaus that run everything.
And you can even be a libertarian and hate government, but you know what? We need it. Like, in times like these, you look at it and you say, okay, Rand Paul or whatever crazy libertarian dude, like, all right, so.
So how, where's the market stepping in to fix it?
Yeah. Fix it. Invisible hand.
Yeah, please.
Please.
I wish it would.
Something.
Make me a libertarian tomorrow. I would love the invisible hand to swoop in and save lives in Puerto Rico.
Yep. Waiting for it. Just can't wait. Because we have no functional government.
Right. So now's the chance, right?
Yeah.
And they waived the Jones Act. So, you know, AT&T and Halliburton want to swoop in and fix this?
Yeah. Rebuild Puerto Rico, save lives, drain water, all the things, save all these lives. Please.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, government is necessary. And in times of crisis and in times of disaster, having a functional government is essential.
Yes.
And when you elect someone like this man, it does damage more far-reaching than his fucking tweets and, you know, his ineptitude and his you know, lowering our standing in the world. It makes the government ineffective and it kills people.
So I want to share two pieces of information, and then I'll bring up another Bush who did a much better job of responding to a natural disaster that I lived through that was far more devastating than what was anticipated.
Okay.
I've talked about Hurricane Andrew before.
Yes.
1992, direct hit on South Florida, right where I lived. The eye passed like 15 miles south of my apartment.
Yeah.
My school was totally destroyed because it was in the eye. So Andrew was sort of a weird storm, and it was very small and compact, but because of its like low pressure, it spawned a lot of tornadoes in addition to yeah. the bad wind. So the destruction was like on a much bigger scale, and it wasn't like a rain event, it was a wind event.
Right.
I mean, yeah. So parts of South Dade, which is more, it's semi rural, exurban, suburban. So it's just a lot of houses. There's not a lot of like big city condensed yeah. infrastructure, but a ton of people live there.
Okay.
It was devastated. Some of that was because of shitty building code. Some of that was just being in the path of these tornadoes that the hurricane spawned. And for a few days, for I'd say a solid week, things were starting to get really bad, like really bad in South Dade. There was no power. There was no law enforcement. There was a lot of lack of running water. George H.W. Bush
yes.
stepped in. The National Guard came in, I think, within a week. FEMA came in within a week. And at the very least, like the bare essentials very quickly were there. I remember, I think within 2 or 3 days there at the JCC, which was right next to my apartment, there was, and I don't remember who organized it, but there was this huge drive to hand out food and water and ice and supplies. And I went and volunteered. I was 15, so I felt good about myself. So nice. I volunteered for a day, I think I volunteered multiple days, but I remember like within 2 days, like that popped up, that was there.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was the response of the federal government. Even Reagan disciple George H.W. Bush understood his responsibility for the federal government
yes.
to come in
a disaster area
and take care of it. And as a result of that, really the loss of life for this devastating storm, this is back in 1992, was way less than it could have been. I forget the numbers, but I think it was like less than 20.
Wow.
So, and most of that was directly storm. Actually, most of that was like in the aftermath, people getting crushed by a tree when they're trying to fix something, or a live wire that they didn't know about, or, right. you know, stuff that yeah, happens.
Of course.
But it wasn't like, because there was an outbreak of cholera or people died
dying of
thirst.
Dehydration.
Yeah, no.
And, yeah.
Because the government stepped in and addressed it. And it took a few days, but they did it.
Of course they did.
They did. The National Guard was there handing out food, handing out water, you know.
What, are they just going to be like, oh, I guess all those people in Miami should just starve to death? No, it's America. We don't do that. We go in, we save the day, we help.
Now, look, in I don't want to say in Trump's defense, but Puerto Rico is different. It is an island. You had certain statutes that needed to be fixed or waived. It's a little more complicated. That being said, this is 0 hour now. Now you're in the real danger of people actually dying of thirst and starving. And I heard a rumor this morning that there might be an outbreak of cholera.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. But these are the public health events that happen. And there's more than cholera that could possibly happen. So this is a catastrophe. And it's a catastrophe that needs real leadership and needs to be addressed now. Not tomorrow. Not next week. You know, Trump is finally scheduled to go there, I think, this coming Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So he can, I guess, look out the window like George W. Bush and, oh, gee, that looks bad. I guess we should do something. Like,
I guess. Do you have to put it in front of his face for him to understand how bad it is, I guess? I don't know. I don't know.
Or Ivanka to come crying into the Oval Office? I mean,
oh, Dad, I
don't want those
don't
people
know.
To die. I'll sit on your lap, you know, whatever the fuck it takes.
Right.
So the point is, without being overly cheeky about it, unless dramatic action is taken by the federal government now. And it doesn't have to be Trump. You know, General Kelly, if you want to get off your ass and do something. If I'm Ben Carson, guys.
He has nothing to do with it. But yeah, I mean, who cares? Just somebody. No,
anybody.
Something.
Somebody. Anybody.
Like Hillary Clinton, who should be the president, tweets, hey, there's this thing that you should send that's specifically for this purpose. And as soon as she tweets it, like, what, 2 hours later, they were like, oh, we discovered this thing that we exist, this giant vessel that's intended for relief efforts on islands. We decided to send it.
Oh, she said send it. And they're like, shut up, Hillary Clinton, like the media and everybody else. And then they send it. But
who said shut up? Like, she's like, hey, P.S.
New York Times, because that's their thing. But anyway, the point is, I have a feeling that like Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation and Obama could be more sort of direct and involved with doing like personal relief efforts herself, but they're trying to give Trump a chance to do his job. And then I think at a certain point in the next day or two, they might realize like he can't and people are going to die. I better step up and take on the role I don't have anymore or I didn't get, because this guy can't do it and lives are at stake. It would not surprise me at all.
What are they going to do? They don't have any power.
I think if they were there with their face, it might spur some more action, maybe private action, maybe more foundation action, maybe things like that. But no, you're right. I mean, they can't order FEMA to do anything.
No, they can't. They don't. That's or the National Guard. Elections have fucking consequences.
Yeah.
This man is in charge, whether we like it or not, and nobody does right now.
Yeah.
Whether people are going to die or not going to die matters, but is dependent upon the man who is in office right now. And that's determined by that fucking lever pull that made you feel so good.
I think Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton could make themselves more physically visible. I'm not saying they should. I'm saying they could make themselves more physically visible. First of all, I don't think they want the media circus to get in the way of relief efforts, obviously.
Well, W and Obama and Bill Clinton started a hurricane relief effort.
Yeah, I saw that.
So they're doing a lot of fundraising privately for that. And of course, they're great for that because they know everyone and everyone loves them. And the fact that it's the three of them, I think, is a tripartisan sort of effort. I just don't know what they can do.
Which, to their credit, the Bushes and the Clintons have been doing for like 20 years now.
Yeah.
Which is great.
But outside of that, I really don't know what they're supposed to, what can they do?
You know what? I don't think they know either, but I think they have to try to do something.
I'm not convinced that she's not making calls to the State Department and saying, what the fuck is going on over there?
I'm sure she's making calls around the clock, but I think if they may discover or think that if we could make ourselves much more visible here, it might spur some more action. And the federal government is just not in a position to properly respond right. I don't know. I might be totally wrong about that. And I think their first instinct is do not get in the way and create a media circus.
Right. And don't make it a partisan thing or see they hate me. And then he gets to like have a feel about it. And then more things.
I think they care less about that.
I don't think so. Because when Donald Trump has a feeling, everything stops. Any action he was going to take, anything he was going to do, the world stops so that he can have a fucking tantrum. And I think they're trying to prevent that.
Maybe if Obama poked his head up in Puerto Rico, maybe he would provoke Trump to actually get off his ass and do something.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously.
But that just seems so like, it's not his fucking job.
No. It's not his job. But right now, nobody's doing their job and people are dying. That's the point.
I just don't want to rest all of this on Obama and Clinton.
No, I don't either. I don't either. It's not their job.
Their lack of doing something is causing this. You know?
No, that's not what I'm saying. The point is they might be in a position where they're like, maybe I can just break all the rules of my position and actually do something to help these people. That's all I'm saying.
The president could just do his fucking job.
Don't count on that. It's not going to happen. He's A, incapable of doing his job. B, has no interest in doing his job.
Yeah.
So before this even broke in the last few days with the way Trump has been behaving towards Puerto Rico, I wanted to reinforce the point and point out that what we have here is a situation where there's only one thing that motivates this president. One thing, period. I mean, besides enriching himself and his cronies and his family, the only motivation for this president, and we talked about this, that Nancy and Chuck decoded this a few weeks ago and figured this out, is his perception and what is being said about him.
Right.
And his is he being adored enough
yes.
to satisfy his ego? That's it.
Right.
That's all he cares about.
Right. And there was a really, really great article that came out earlier this week that is very snarky and very depressing that goes to exactly that point and just says exactly that. Like, this president does not care about anything, doesn't know about anything. And the reason he doesn't know is because if it doesn't affect him directly, it doesn't matter.
No. And if it doesn't have to do with the way he's being treated or perceived.
Mm-hmm. Or perceives that he's being treated.
Then it's irrelevant.
It doesn't matter at all. It's never going to matter. There's never going to be a pivot. He doesn't care.
No.
About anything except himself.
No. And he doesn't care about how that very perception itself, to get really meta, he doesn't care that perception makes him look worse.
No.
None of that matters at all. No.
No.
So let me put it another way. Some people are really just taken aback today and being, the president of the United States is now in this personal battle with the mayor of this place.
Disaster ridden city.
Why is he doing this?
And why wouldn't he?
And the answer is because that's all that motivates him. He took a personal offense to the mayor saying the federal government or Trump are not doing enough. And now it's a personal battle, and that's all that matters. And his flacks are going to back him up because that's all they can do. Todd Starnes and Sarah Huckabee Sanders. That's all they can do. And all they can do is rally the base and say the media only cares about, going after Trump.
And why are these people so lazy?
That was a little added touch, right?
Right.
Yeah. That was a little, icing.
This is not new. Back when Katrina hit, there was this article that my dad sent me, and it was, I guess it was around the 2008 election. So it was a couple years after Katrina. Katrina was in 2005. And he sent me this article that was written by someone from Alaska, I want to say. And the article was about how, look at all these people in this hurricane, and they, they're so devastated and they need all this help. And, it starts off like, yeah, that's all true. Sure, sure. And then this article, it's like not an article, it's like an editorial or whatever, but it recounts how in Alaska they had this terrible, terrible blizzard, and it shut down all of their power. And they, there was feet and feet and feet of snow, and the whole community was, devastated and blah, blah, blah. And then it recounts how people got out their snowmobiles and started digging their friends and family out. And, they cleared the roads themselves, and they,
so it's all self-reliance. And why don't these people,
had generators, and they were powering their homes and their neighbors' homes. And then, Sue down the street was cooking a big pot of chili for all the people who helped her get her dog, this sort of narrative, right, about Alaska and how they
upper middle class white people get huge oil tax subsidies
and how they all came together as a community. And they didn't
unlike
need
all the poor people
they
in
didn't
New Orleans.
Need the federal government, right? They as a community rebuilt themselves. They didn't need anybody.
Yeah.
And then you look at all these brown people in New Orleans,
and they're just
and why can't they just get the water out of there? And why don't they have generators? And why don't they have snow plows? And why don't they have the things that they need to be self-reliant? Da da da. And I remember reading it and just thinking, like, God, my dad is really racist, because he doesn't even see it that way at all. He reads that and he goes, God damn right. Even during the first hurricane this time around in Houston, right, my dad was like, if I was there, I'd get my boat and I'd go help those people, all that. That he doesn't even realize that, like, talking about Alaska in that way and then looking at the devastation that happened in New Orleans and how those two things cannot possibly even be compared.
No.
And this is a small town in Alaska, in rural Alaska, versus a major metropolitan city with millions of people living there.
Millions of poor people.
Millions of poor people.
Don't have snowmobiles.
They don't have...
or boats. Or,
nope. No. They have rafts, maybe. They don't.
They don't have the means to do what your rich white people in Alaska...
And by the way,
middle class.
The actual infrastructure of the city is what failed them.
Yes.
The levees fucking broke.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, it was really rainy, why weren't they prepared? The fucking levees that were supposed to hold the water back that were built by the goddamn army... broke
and swamped their
and
homes.
Completely destroyed the city.
Yeah.
This is not a fucking snowstorm. This is a failure of the infrastructure that's supposed to protect the city that's below sea level that failed.
Yeah.
And destroyed a major metropolitan area full of underemployed, poor people, particularly the people in the Ninth Ward, which was the lowest level.
Which was the worst hit.
Which was the worst hit, which was also the most impoverished neighborhood.
Well, I don't know if you remember this, but you actually had people in Congress standing up and saying, you know what, it's going to be really expensive to fix New Orleans. That's just not. And fortunately, they were drowned out, even by other very conservatives who were like, no, we can't do that. Shut up.
Right.
You know?
Oh, no, I know more. Katrina's my thing.
Yeah.
Because I was very personally affected by it. I didn't live there, but like
My people were there.
That was sort of the first like warning sign that, you know, there's some really evil people in the Republican Party. Because no Democrats were saying that, obviously.
Of course not. No, it was this very like, well, you know.
Can you imagine somebody saying that about Houston? Even though there's a lot of black people in Houston, but there's a lot of white people too. So can you imagine somebody coming out and saying like, you know, it's going to be really expensive to fix Houston.
I mean, when Sandy hit, there was definitely, Ted Cruz even was just like, it's really expensive. And you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's New York City.
Well, it was mostly, it was like New Jersey and upstate New York and Long Island mostly.
But you know, but like, what are you doing? What are you even, so anyway, I forget where I was going with that. But yeah, I mean, the racialized language, I guess, is where I was getting at behind this idea of like, why can't they just help themselves?
Right, Trump and what Trump is saying today
isn't new. It was, it existed back when Katrina hit. We don't hear it when it happens to Houston. We don't hear it when it happens to Florida, but we hear it when it happens to a place like New Orleans or a place like Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
It's mostly brown folks.
Yep. So, I mean, that's the part of, I think, of his tweet storm this morning that might be overlooked a little bit.
That's the part that hit me the hardest.
Yeah.
I don't care about the personal battle between him and her. I care about that depiction of the people who live there as being lazy and entitled, and why can't they just help themselves?
It's pretty gross. Now, here's the thing, right? Republican leadership in both houses needs to say something to this. And besides just Jeff Flake and Marco Rubio, right?
Right.
Because Rubio's going to say something because there's the big Puerto Rican contingent in his...
Yes, in Florida.
...that he represents.
Plus, his state just got bombasted by a hurricane, so...
Yeah. Jeff Flake, obviously, because he is determined to be critical of the president when it's warranted, but it's got to be more than him. And like sometimes Lindsey Graham maybe, but like we need more. We need Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, the leadership to say, this is not okay. Or to take some leadership in like maybe pushing some legislation through or enacting some emergency powers or doing something.
Something, anything. Like, fucking crickets from the Republican Party.
Silence,
you're in power now. That's the thing.
Silence,
you're in fucking power.
Yeah, silence or saying, I don't agree with these tweets is not enough. And I'm very fearful that's all we're going to get.
Yes.
Which is why he keeps doing this, because there's nothing to check him except for bad news cycles.
Back to elections have consequences. We also elected a Republican Congress. Mm-hmm. So Republican Congress, Republican president. All right. You got what you wanted. You're in charge. Do fucking something now. Yeah. Do something.
Yeah.
Be in charge. Get something done. Help these fucking people. You wanted it. You have it. Now do something.
Well, they didn't want the responsibility of having to do something. They wanted to be in power.
Right. And they don't really know
pass tax cuts.
How to do anything.
Yeah.
They just know that they didn't want us to do anything. They're good at that.
Yeah. Very good at that. And campaigning off that. And fundraising off that. And winning elections off that.
Yes.
Actually governing,
no. Don't, what do you mean?
Right.
That's not a thing.
Yeah.
We never learned how to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we've exhausted the Puerto Rico topic, only to reinforce that we are on the verge of a major, major loss of life event, potentially.
Yes.
I'm not saying that's definitely going to happen. I'm not completely sort of giving up and saying, okay, well, the Trump administration and the federal government has completely failed and can't rectify the situation, but I'm very, very pessimistic. And
I'm very
concerned.
Scared. Yeah, I'm really scared. And I'm really, really, really hope they get it together.
And ironically,
I hope he does a great job. I hope from here on out he decides this is important and he gets all his shit together and all the ducks in a row and he goes in and swoops in and saves the day and saves lives. I would love nothing more than to come back next week and say, God damn
job.
It, he did a great fucking job.
He got off to a slow start, but
realized how bad it was, he really got his shit together and God damn it, people in Puerto Rico are going to be okay.
Yeah,
I'd love to say that next
week. Yeah, because for us, this is about the people. It's not about him.
Political
pissing
match. I don't care. I would love to come on this podcast next week and praise him.
Yeah.
Because that would mean that everything was going to be okay.
Yeah. Or way better than
or way better. Or at least like we're really making some progress and people are really starting to see results and there's not been a massive loss of life and like we're doing okay. It's going to like we're on the right track. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love to say that next week. So I really, really hope that happens.
Yeah.
I'm scared it might not. Really, really deeply concerned. That it might
I'm
not.
Pretty convinced that that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But we'll see. I guess I had one closing point about this that I kind of forgot. There's still very much the feeling that even if conservatives and the administration sort of concedes these are American citizens, there's still very much the air of these are second class citizens.
Very much so.
Which is also the underlying sort of theme of those tweets this morning, right?
Yes. Yes. Very much so.
I mean, he wouldn't dare say about Texans like they need to help themselves and they're relying too much on the federal government. I mean, come on.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
People in Florida?
Oh. No.
Why isn't the community coming together? Why do they want everyone to do everything for them?
Right.
You would never say that.
No.
Ever.
No. No. So that's kind of where we are as far as that goes. There's a lot more to talk about. What do you want to squeeze in before the break? We're
going to talk an awful lot about race after the break. So let's do something that's a little light, but very near and dear to my heart.
Okay.
As by way of switching topics.
Okay, go ahead.
You know my deep and abiding love for the Satanic Temple, yes.
Yeah, I do.
I love them. I did a whole piece on this with Arliss and Will on Hopping Mad. And we talked about the various ways that they are using legal tools to enforce separation of church and state.
I'm listening.
So they have a new tactic, and I want to talk about it.
Okay.
So as we know, the Supreme Court of the United States is going to hear a case that's pretty near to us. A bakery in Lakewood, where I live, has refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple.
Mm-hmm. By the way, again, Rachel lives in Lakewood.
I live in Lakewood. This is a master cake bakery, master shop bakery, something like
master
that.
Master baking cake. Something.
Yeah, no, I can't do that. So anyway, they refused to bake a wedding cake for this gay couple. The gay couple filed discrimination charges because in the state of Colorado, sexual orientation is a protected class.
Right.
Protected class, again, for anybody who doesn't really understand how this works, because it's going to get a teeny bit legalese here. The federal government protects under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Protects, right, like race, creed, religion, and gender mm-hmm. as protected classes. Sexual orientation is not included in the federal Civil Rights Act. In Colorado, we have our own Civil Rights Act, and sexual orientation is included.
Yeah.
And what that means is that you can't get denied what are called public accommodations. If you're a business that serves the public, you're a bakery, you're a bar, you're a restaurant, you're a hotel. Yeah. You can't say,
I'm not going to serve you because you're gay.
Because you're gay, or because you're black, or because you're a woman, or because you're a Muslim, right?
Right. You can't.
In Colorado. Right. At the federal level, you can't do that to the black person, the Muslim, the woman, but you absolutely can to a gay person.
Yeah.
And so that's...
Under the rationale that it affects your sincerely held religious beliefs.
Correct.
Which the logic of that is so ridiculous, but...
But that's what the brilliance of the Satanic Temple is. Okay. So... The Supreme Court's going to hear this case, bigot fucking bakers versus gay couple. And the Trump administration, the DOJ, has just come out on the side of the baker.
Of course. And Jeff Sessions, DOJ.
Yes. But it's also suing the baker. So the federal government's suing itself, essentially.
Yeah.
The federal government is on both sides of this case.
Right. Because the former Department of Justice was...
The former administration said, of course, we were on the side of the gay couple because it's a public accommodation and discrimination. Yeah. Okay, so here's the brilliance. All right. So the Satanic Temple said, all right, well, you're allowed to discriminate against me based on sexual orientation, right? You're allowed to say, I'm not going to bake you a cake because you're gay. Mm-hmm. Guess what you're not allowed to say? I'm not going to bake you a cake because you're a Muslim. Mm-hmm. Or a Satanist. Because
yeah,
religion is a protected class.
Yeah.
So what they're doing is they're calling on people who have been refused service by a baker. And they're going to go to those bakers, these evangelical Christians who refuse to bake gay cakes because of their sincerely held religious
beliefs.
And
now they're
going to
bake pentagram cakes.
They are going to bake Satanist cakes. And they're not allowed to discriminate. They're not allowed to say, well, it violates my sincerely held religious beliefs. Well, those are my sincerely held religious beliefs that you're opposed to. You can't do that. You cannot discriminate based on someone's religion under the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964.
And they're smart and they have good lawyers and they know
how
to argue
this. And so they're
going
to go and they're going to make evangelical Christians bake cakes honoring Satan.
And of course, the thought process is... They might start to rethink this and be like, yeah, maybe baking a cake for gay couples isn't that bad after all.
You either take religion out of this or you honor every religion.
That's
the whole
right.
point is separation of church and state.
Right.
They don't really give a shit about Satan cakes.
No, of course not.
They just want you to not be able to use religion as a reason to
Although
discriminate.
That one cake you showed me, you looked really good.
I know, like it's red velvet. And shit. Yeah, it looks delicious.
Black frosting.
So it's fucking brilliant though, right? I mean, and the legal framework that they're using, you cannot argue against. They're using the exact language of the Civil Rights Act and the exact language of the evangelicals who are refusing to do this and saying, we are also a religious organization with deeply held religious
and they're probably hoping that the initial courts just sort of pass it off or so they can kick it up the chain further and further and make more publicity out of it.
It's not about publicity. It's about ultimately the goal is we no longer have religious rights refusal, right? Like this, mm-hmm. the freedom of religion bullshit.
Right.
We have separation of church and state.
Yeah.
And so in public accommodations, you are not allowed to discriminate. I don't give a shit what your religion is.
Right.
That's their point.
Right.
They want to actually affect public policy and the law. But right. in order to do that, and it's, you know, it's pissing all these people off. Even
of course.
Some people on the left are like, ugh, why is it about Satan
right,
cakes? And you're
right.
like, don't, no. Listen to the legal argument they're making, and it's goddamn brilliant because mm-hmm. there's no way that the evangelical Christian can refuse to make a cake for you because it's about Satan.
Right.
Because that's a protected class.
Right.
So you either don't discriminate against anybody or, yeah, I mean, that's it. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
I love them. So also, on a side note, because we're about to go to break, Lucian Graves, who's the spokesperson for the Satanic Temple, went on Tucker Carlson. And he's been talking about this for a while. He was supposed to be on, I think it was last week or the week before, and Tucker Carlson had to cancel it for, I don't remember why. I think hurricane-related reasons. Mm-hmm. And so he finally was on, I guess, last night. And I guess it did not go well for Mr. Carlson.
Usually doesn't.
He was trying to say that, like, hilariously, you can't push your religious beliefs on us. Like, why don't you? And he was like, so,
the chutzpah, Tucker.
So
chutzpah.
He's like, I agree with you. If you keep your religion at home, in private, behind closed doors, and in your church at home, or in private, behind church doors, I will too. But you and your elected representatives are bringing your religion and shoving it down my throat. And that's what I'm doing back. I'm just doing exactly what you're doing. It's just a different religion. Mm-hmm. And his response was like, you must have had a very unhappy childhood. And then he was talking about something else and Tucker Carlson just cut him off and was like, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't even make sense. Like because there's no argument to be made.
Right.
If you're talking about religious freedom in this country as a Christian and you're talking to someone of a different religion and yeah, they're out there to get you. They are. That's the point.
Yeah.
But they're using the exact same language that you use. There's just no argument
no
to be made
around.
Against
yeah.
it. And so he just was like, acted like a 5-year-old, I guess. And just was like,
at least he had him on the show. Most people wouldn't.
Yeah.
I don't think Hannity would have him on the show.
No, but yeah. So I guess it was pretty great.
I'm sure.
Frustrating to watch, certainly. But, yeah, I think they're doing some good work. I appreciate, and I was talking to Dana the other day and I was like, I'd love to know who their lawyers are. Like not the public lawyer, the person who's representing them sort of mm-hmm. In court and in the media, but like the legal team behind some of these things that they're doing, you know, it's got to be like big people, like the greatest minds in law are like sending memos like, hey, P.S., this is a thing you might use, mm-hmm. you know, and then they have their like PR thing to do it. But I just wonder sometimes who the legal minds are behind their very, very brilliant and very clever legal strategies.
Well, we're coming up on the break. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about the old NFL kerfuffle. And today the NBA has come out with a statement they're going to regret, and I'll get to that.
Okay.
We're going to talk about the S-CHIP program that the Republicans have not been able to renew, which is going to be really, really bad and really bad for them, but most importantly, really, really bad for poor kids. Because of their stupid, protracted, now failed latest Obamacare zombie care repeal fight, which we haven't even talked about. That I guess that happened earlier this week that it fell apart, or was that?
I think we talked about it last week, but
last week. Okay.
I can't remember. But yeah, we have a lot to talk about.
We have a lot to talk about. We'll get to it. A lot about race and things like that. Maybe even get in some North Korea talk.
Hopefully.
So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back to Reverend Testimony. I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. Did we want to talk about the NFL?
Yeah, I want to talk about the NFL and race and say some things. So, okay. Do you want to give a little background about the NFL protests and then I'll get into...
Sure. I mean, if you haven't been following it, basically last season, while Colin Kaepernick was still employed by the NFL, he started doing this thing where he would kneel during the national anthem as a protest for police violence against people of color. That was basically it.
Yes.
And he made it very clear what he was doing and why he was doing it.
Yes.
It wasn't like anti-America or anti-military, or it was very specifically that, and he made it clear in no uncertain terms what it was about.
Yes. And as a side note, I read something really interesting this week, which was that he used to sit and...
Right. He would just sit. He would just wouldn't stand.
Just wouldn't stand. Right. And the story goes, and I have not independently fact checked that this is true, but I've seen it a bunch of places, was that there was a veteran who wrote him a letter and said, I understand what you're doing. And I, of course, fought for your right to do it. But from my perspective, you know, this is why it's disrespectful to the troops and the flag and the blah, blah, blah. And so Colin Kaepernick wrote back and he said, I'd love to have a conversation with you about this. And so they did. And they sat down and they had a conversation and they agreed that rather than sit during the national anthem, it would be more effective and also more respectful if he would kneel. Because mm-hmm. kneeling is a sign of respect for people who are wounded. The soldier guy was saying, like, on the battleground, people kneel, or like at like soldiers' funerals, they do. And then there's like the old, you know, kids' sports team, somebody gets injured and everybody kneels.
Well, you know what else the sports ball people do? And yeah. I have obviously never gotten on this, but before or after a game, they love to kneel and pray.
Right.
They do this a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, these two people who had different opinions got together and anyway, he started to kneel, but that became a more visible thing that he was doing. And that's when it kind of picked up steam and the world kind of exploded. And isn't he awful and disrespectful and ungrateful?
Oh yeah. And all especially among the right wing. Yeah.
Yes. So then he did not get picked, right?
He was released by San Francisco, who he played for and played pretty well with last year, and nobody picked him up despite the fact that he could still obviously play. Even if he's just a backup, he can still help a lot of teams, but basically no general manager wanted that, if you want to call it a distraction or that sideshow or right. that kind of heat on their organization. I think the only football element to it is like if he was as good as he was a couple years ago, somebody might take that chance, and somebody still might if they get a bad injury to their starting quarterback. But
I heard
basically nobody wants to deal with the press circus around it.
Right. Dana and I tried to talk about this last week as people who know nothing about sports.
I could have gave you a little more context.
I know. Yeah. Yes. But I someone said
he's still like good enough to be in the league.
Seventh best quarterback or something some year. Mm-hmm. And like there's way more than seven teams, so you'd think somebody would want him. But anyway.
Oh, he played in the Super Bowl and played well a few years ago.
So then Sunday happened. Do you want to talk about all the things on Sunday?
Well, I mean, to make a long story short, Trump sort of lost his mind on Twitter, and most teams responded by doing something. A bunch of them, like, all kneeled in unison. A bunch of them sort of kneeled right before the national anthem, then stood up. But the point is, like, almost everybody or a bunch of people from almost every team kneeled, basically, as a fuck you to Trump.
Yes.
When he said, don't you dare kneel at all.
Right.
Or else you're anti-patriotic, anti-American, and you should be fired.
And he said he called Colin Kaepernick a son of a bitch who should be fired.
Yeah, in his Alabama, he had a big Alabama rally.
Right. And said, like, any like respectable team owner or coach would just fire these people if they kneel for the national anthem, blah, blah, blah. So then everybody reacted by kneeling.
And a whole bunch of team owners are big Trump donors, by the way.
Yeah, a lot of them.
And now he's calling basically for a general NFL boycott because of this.
Right.
I wonder what they think now about their big Trump support.
I think there were Shannon Sharp, I saw an interview with, who said there were like seven owners who gave at least $1 million to Trump's campaign.
Yeah, Daniel Snyder and Woody Johnson.
Yeah. Yeah, he called them all out specifically by name.
Mm-hmm.
And basically said, you know, it wasn't enough when he did this. It wasn't enough when he did that. But don't tell rich white people what to do.
Yeah,
and that's what really got them.
Right.
Yeah, he is. It was a fucking great interview.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, you should watch it. But anyway, so that's the backdrop for what I want to talk about today. And I just want to point out, I'm going to read this article. And I just want to say something about, as a white person who cares about race, the importance of seeking out journalists and writers and authors who are not me. I can read white people talk about race that share my perspective, that want the same things that I do, all day long. And what I'm getting by doing that is getting my own worldview spat back out at me.
Sure. Yeah, echo chamber, which we all do because it's comfortable.
But what I think is important is when we're talking about issues like race or issues like the Muslim ban or gay marriage or sexism, I think it's important to seek out people whose worldview is shaped by those things.
Absolutely. To get the perspective of somebody not you.
So I've been seeking out authors and writers and journalists of color this week because I, like I said, I can listen to white people talk about this all day long, but it's just the same shit that I think. I'd like to hear what they think.
Yes.
I would like to hear their perspective on all of this and what's been happening.
You always learn new stuff. You learn stuff from a different perspective.
Yeah.
And very, very often they say things that challenge your own notions.
That's right.
And a lot of white people, especially progressive white people, aren't always comfortable with that.
Right.
Like we saw this with, went on with Chris Hayes the other night.
Yes. This has been a topic for me lately, this past week, white defensiveness. This idea that, you know, Republicans and conservative people tend to just be sort of more overtly racist.
Yeah.
And then progressive white people like us, there's a lot of this in the feminist community, which I am very aware of, but it happens everywhere in all communities that aren't we inclusive? Aren't we great? This is the thing we're fighting for. And a person of color comes to you and says something incredibly valid and very clearly obvious that is a problem with your organization.
And we get defensive.
And white defensiveness kicks in. Everyone jumps on your throat and you're mean and that's not what really... And no, let me just explain. And and nobody stops to fucking...
Listen.
Yeah. Don't get into defensiveness. Stop. Don't let your brain do anything else other than listen and absorb. And then think about how, if that challenges you or if that makes you uncomfortable, which is the thing I'm about to read is going to make a lot of people pretty uncomfortable, which is why I'm about to read it.
Good.
When I piss you off when I'm reading this, just really that moment when you feel it, I would like you to just self-reflect for a minute.
And why sometimes maybe it's not... upset? Personal defensiveness of yourself, but defensiveness of like white people as a whole or other white progressive organizations or your political party or the politician you support. It's like,
okay,
you got to be open to it. Like so many of our close friends, right? If there's any criticism of Obama, they're just knee jerk fought against it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yes, we love Obama, but he's not above any criticism. We should discuss this, whether it was drones or economic things or some things we...
I mean, the classic case is the Bernie Bros, right?
Oh,
as soon as
worst.
You talk about race, they jump into hyper-defensive mode and attack mode.
Yeah.
Right? That's how white defensiveness does itself, is it says, I'm trying to help you. Why won't you let me? You're being mean.
Yeah.
Therefore, you're wrong and I don't like you anymore. And you don't know I'm doing what's best for you.
Right.
You don't know what's best for you. And that's so patronizing and not productive and not helpful.
Not at all.
So I'm going to read this article because it pertains directly to this conversation and the protest. And it is called, it's from The Root, written by Michael Harriet.
Mm-hmm.
It is called How to Protest Without Offending White People.
Yeah.
And it's the greatest thing I've read all week. Many people were surprised when President Donald Trump suggested that NFL team owners fire players who quietly chose to sit out the national anthem before games, but I was not one of them. Even though they thought they'd solved the anthem problem by blackballing protest starter Colin Kaepernick, the residual insolence displayed by the players roiled white people to no end because their protest was so disrespectful. Not to a 250-year-old cloth logo or a Francis Scott Key bar song. Taking a knee is disrespectful to whiteness. It's not that white people can't understand Kaepernick's point of view. It's that to them, any other point of view is non-existent. For future reference, we've put together this handy-dandy checklist for designing a protest that white people will find inoffensive and respectable. Number one, don't say white. I have no idea why, but white people hate it when anyone uses the phrase white people, because for some reason they consider it a pejorative. When protesting police brutality, education inequality, unfair housing practices, or anything else, you must be careful not to, quote, make it about race, even if the thing you're protesting is all about race.
Yeah.
Like refer to racism as a, quote, social issue. Instead of slinging the phrase white supremacy around all willy-nilly, you can instead refer to it as structural inequality. If your, quote, underprivileged child has been fenced into a poorly funded educational system, call it an inner city school. Uttering the words white people only serves as a reminder of their historic ties to oppression, which can be only negated by their instinctual regurgitation of the preamble to all white excuses. Not all white people. Mm. Even if you make your protest about a, quote, societal issue that's not about race, you still shouldn't expect them to join in or approve. They already heard you say white people. Don't say black. When protesting, you must not only refrain from lumping Caucasians together, but you must also be careful not to remind them of your blackness. Again, the word conjures the imagery of oppression and makes everything about race. Plus, it's divisive. Any mention of race is divisive because it overlooks the fact that every color and creed has problems. Some people have to worry about the leader of the free world trying to deport their children, vilifying their religion, or referring to their mothers as bitches, while others have to live with the terrible burden of people constantly belittling their chicken seasoning and potato salad making.
Oh.
We all have a struggle. Be inclusive. If there is one thing white people, and then it's scratched out, outer city people hate, because we can't say white, remember? Yeah. It's being left out. If you watch the nation unite in empathy and mourning for the single Caucasian victim of white supremacy, while ignoring the fact that the same supremacists have terrorized people of color for more than a century, when you see Justine Damon's death change the leadership of an entire police force while the streets run red with black blood spilled by acquitted police officers, you still shouldn't say Black Lives Matter. Even if there has never been a nanosecond in the long history of America during which anyone questioned the worth of white lives, you must still include them. You should also be inclusive enough to make up an entire new category of human being and announce that blue lives matter too.
Oh, God.
Unless you hate cops and Smurfs. The invisible, white people, or the average American doesn't mind protest, as long as he or she can't see it.
Mm.
You absolutely have the constitutional right to feel a little morose whenever your son, neighbor, or fellow citizen is shot, choked, beaten, or discriminated against. As long as you don't obstruct the weekend Caucasian commute to the mall to purchase yoga pants. Why should they have to think about the disproportionate continual murder of black people when they're trying to get half-price cargo shorts at the Gap? That's just un-American.
Yeah, it is.
You can object to inequality as much as you like, as long as it isn't at sporting events. No one wants to think about politics at sporting events, or political rallies, or inaugurations, or on social media, or at schools, or at actual protests. But everywhere else is fine. Be respectful. If you miraculously find a place to protest, find an inoffensive phrase, and include people from all groups, you should still be mindful that there's a list of things that the overprivileged, value more than your life, freedom, equality, or happiness. Your civil disobedience must not offend or disparage any of the following. Flags that represent America, flags that represent traitors to America, monuments, names of buildings, statues, stained glass windows, cats, American flags, 150-year-old songs, freedom of speech, but only their freedom of speech, not yours.
Right.
Bathrooms, dogs, the children, not the children, but the children. The founding fathers, first responders, blue lives, religious freedom, Christian only, traffic, and troops. Especially troops. White people love troops. They can watch a cop shoot an unarmed person in the head and see the brain matter splatter on his or her baby in the backseat and feel no empathy, but burst into tears when someone shows them a clip of a dog licking a soldier's face when he comes home from killing brown people somewhere in the world or protecting their freedom.
Mm.
In fact, if you wrap a puppy in an American flag and put it on top of a pumpkin spice gift certificate to Starbucks and tell a white woman you're giving it to a soldier, she will spontaneously orgasm.
Okay.
Real talk.
Damn. Okay. A little over the top here, but I get
oh,
it.
Oh, no, no. No. Be dead.
Yeah.
One of the surest ways to engender respect from white people, the unmelanated, is to die. If you don't feel like dying and have white enough teeth, you can alternately outlive their vitriol and wait for them to embrace you. Muhammad Ali was considered a traitor when he stood up for his rights and refused to fight in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy Smith and John Carlos were vilified. Gallup polling recounts Martin Luther King Jr.'s favorability this way. In 1963, King had a 41% positive and 37% negative approval rating. In 1964, it was 43% positive, 39% negative. In 1965, 45% positive, 45% negative. And in 1966, the last Gallup measure of King using this scalometer, it was 32% positive and 63% negative.
Wow.
5 months before the March on Washington, 60% of the country had a negative view of the event. 57% thought that peaceful sit-ins hurt the civil rights movement.
Oh, yeah.
Even a year later, in 1964, 73% of Americans believed, quote, Negroes should stop mass demonstration, according to Gallup.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
There has never been a movement for the freedom or equality of people of color that has gained white approval. Not the abolitionist movement, not the anti-lynching movement, not the Black Power movement, not the civil rights struggle. Looking for respectability and approval from white people will always be as fruitless a task as a chicken's attempt to convince a fox to respect the boundaries of the hen house. In fact, historical, anecdotal, and empirical evidence shows there's only one way to protest without offending white people. Don't.
Yeah. And that's brilliant.
It's the greatest thing that's ever existed.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. And I knew all that stuff about King from the mainstream white America was not this hero to be revered.
Right.
And, like, you know, people like Rush Limbaugh, they get that. They remember that. They're old enough to remember that. So like, oh, can you believe that Limbaugh says mean things about Martin Luther King, which he's done his whole career.
And John Lewis.
Yeah. It's because there's a market for that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the mainstream press doesn't like to talk about that or pretend that exists anymore, but there is a market for that.
Yeah.
Those people are still alive. The children of those people are still alive. Oh, these blacks protesting. Why don't they just be quiet, or they're scary, or, I mean, this is not a new thing, right?
No.
And we're still having these debates, you know, among the chattering classes and the media and everything else. Like, is this the right way to do it?
Here's what I want to say about that. You cannot tell people how to protest their own oppression.
No.
And you cannot tell them not to.
No.
Saying, just sit around and wait, it'll eventually get better, has never made anything better, ever.
No.
And telling people, you protesting your own oppression, whether it be in the streets burning police cars or kneeling or talking or having a march, they're going to protest their own oppression, and they fucking should. And to this article's point, there is no right way for white people, for black people to protest their own oppression. And no matter what they do, right?
Yeah.
Oh, these protests against police and law enforcement in the streets, because after Michael Brown was killed and after all of these countless black men have been murdered at the hands of law enforcement and or a crazy neighborhood watch guy. And there has been no conviction, not a single one. Oh, they're violent. Oh, they're loud. Oh, it's awful. So, you know, if they would just be peaceful. Okay, they're kneeling at a football game. Well, no, that's interrupting sports now. Well, they're blocking traffic. Well, they're being peaceful, but, you know, I can't get through on Jemima Road. Like, it's absolutely infuriating.
Yeah,
there is no right way. That's the whole point of this article. There is no right way.
I want to bring up a guy who has pointed this out, and it's not popular. His name's Dan Le Batard, and you saw him featured a lot on that documentary, The U, about the University of Miami.
Yes, I love that.
Because he's a Miami sports writer, and now he's got like an ESPN talk show, and he's goofy and stupid and sort of a pseudo sports shock jock. But he says some poignant things from time to time. And whenever this comes up, whenever like Ferguson and there's like actual riots and white people call in and say, why are they doing this to their own city? And don't they know this is so detrimental? He says, you have never been in a situation where you are so desperate and nobody is listening to you, and you're completely out of options, and you feel like to be heard, you have absolutely no choice to start smashing shit.
That's right.
You have never, ever been in that situation. And guess what? If throughout history, when white people are in that situation, they do the same fucking thing.
Yeah. Look at the...
in fact, they do it for much dumber reasons. Why don't you go to like a Canadian city after an NHL Stanley Cup win and see what they do?
Or
their
an
own
American city,
just to
after your team loses and or wins.
Yeah,
you know, there's absolutely white people rioting, and that's called like
blowing
mass
off
acceleration.
Steam.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it's always interesting that he's always brought that up. And it actually made me think, because when I was younger and dumber, I kind of used to be like, yeah, why are they smashing their own shit? That's just dumb. And like, you know, it's like, well, you put yourself in their position for a second.
No. Yeah.
And feel so desperate to get anybody to listen to your plight.
Yes.
That there's nothing else to do. And like,
anger boils over at some point.
Yeah.
You know, you walk around all day long and you hold it in and you try to just get through the day as a person of color without dying or, you know, the million little microaggressions all day long, every day.
Sure. And imagine then, like, and living then, in Ferguson.
And then, like, and that. Then you're just allowed to murder black people in the streets and no one is held to account for it. Like, at some point, it's just too fucking much.
Yeah.
It's just too fucking much. And somebody needs to do something. And we're going to, it's boiled over anger and also utter despair and hopelessness. Like, it there's nothing again, you can fucking do.
And it happens again and again and again and again. It happened in Miami a few times in the 80s for the very same reasons.
LA.
It happened in Watts in the 60s. It happened in LA after Rodney King in 1992.
Yep.
And white America doesn't learn from it, really, I don't think. Because as far as the justice system goes, there's more talk about it now, but nothing changes.
Right. Right. Like, there's a greater awareness, I think, in among white people about the issue of racial profiling and law enforcement abuse to minority communities and law enforcement murdering of minority folks. So we're more aware of it. But when it comes to each individual case, our justice system doesn't seem to be reacting in that same way. There have been no convictions in lots of cases. There's not even indictments. I cannot imagine the despair that must come along with that. The only thing that I can say that even draws some partial comparison is looking at the way that sexual assaults are treated in this country.
Yeah.
You know, as a woman, looking at Brock Turner getting 6 months, I mean, at least he was convicted. But he was
convicted with an overwhelming
amount of evidence. That, of course, and then still there's no justice, but at least that, right? At least we have that.
Right.
When you're looking at the murder of black people in the streets by law enforcement, there is no justice.
No.
There is no accountability. Whether it's transparency.
Philando Castile. Yeah. Or the list goes on and on and on. And just last week, another acquittal for a police murder, basically.
Yes, correct. And
And you even have some prosecutors getting more aggressive and actually making the charges now, and they're not sticking.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they're getting acquitted when it gets to the jury.
And what
a lot of times you can't even get a charge.
Where this whole thing comes from, this Black Lives Matter movement, is exactly that.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You can shoot a black man in the street for no goddamn reason, and nothing bad will happen to you because that life didn't matter.
Right. And
that's where this comes from.
And every time I hear all lives matter, I just want to flatten you.
Yep.
Because you don't fucking get it.
Nope. And it is.
You have no clue what this is about.
No.
None at all.
None.
And like, if you're just a strident right wing asshole, like, I get it, and I kind of move on. When I see someone who considers themselves a moderate or apolitical or a progressive say it, I want to steamroll you into the ground.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. We were talking about this the other day. Like, at least right-wingers are overtly racist.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Their agenda is clear, and they're strident and small-minded. And
We get it. You're fucking racist.
Yeah, we get where you're coming from.
But when this starts to happen in my community with my people that supposedly share my same values, no, I will not have it. I will not tolerate it at all.
Speaking of our community, I just thought of something interesting, because the term he used was outer city people.
Yeah.
And Denver's kind of unique in the sense that we're technically in the inner city right now.
Yes.
But the inner city is, Denver is very, very white. And it's the suburbs that are ethnically diverse.
Right. And there are parts like Five Points is traditionally black neighborhood, which has been gentrified. That's the other part of the problem with
Denver, the Highlands.
Is that we're gentrifying it in an insanely quick fashion. But yeah, it is interesting. So parts of Lakewood, certainly Aurora. And in part, that's because of housing.
Yes.
Because it is so fucking expensive to live in this city. Gentrification again. So a lot of the people who used to live in the city have been forced out into the suburbs.
Yes.
Into neighborhoods in the suburbs, which are now being gentrified. And so I don't know where we put these displaced populations of poor people and minorities. And
some of our outlying cities are trying to make it even harder, like Lakewood, which is another thing we could talk about. But anyway, we do have some politics to get to in the last 20 minutes.
Okay. First of all, let me just wrap this up. Okay. So the only other thing I wanted to say about listening to black people is this. There was this article in the Washington Post, and it was about this survey that was done amongst a wide swath of African Americans. And the title is, "Remember when Trump asked blacks, what the hell do you have to lose?"
Right, yeah.
We now have their response. And so let's just get to the Lives and Voices of Black America is a survey that was 1,003 African Americans funded by the Ford Foundation, conducted by Perry Undum and administered by the University of Chicago's NORC AmeriSpeak panel. I would like to say that I'm going to read you some of these stats, and I think that Black Americans may be the only rational demographic we have in this country.
He's one of the few left.
Who thinks the president's policies will have a negative effect on the Black community's ability to have access to quality, affordable health care? 75%. Have access to affordable mental health care? 73%. Child care? 71%. Affordable housing? 70%. Birth control? 68%. Yeah. Legal affordable abortion? 67%. Keep children safe from mass incarceration? 65%.
Again, this is access will he have a detrimental effect on
Correct.
These things?
Yeah. So the overwhelming majority of Black people that were surveyed are absolutely rational and saw this coming.
Yeah.
Next. Ability to, negative effect on the Black community's ability to, have job opportunities that pay a livable wage, 63. Keep children safe from over-policing, 62. Mm. Access to higher education, 62. Equal pay, future elections without barriers, drug addiction, feel safe in our neighborhoods, equal opportunities to move up in the workplace, raise children. I mean, all of these are above 60%.
Can I point something out? I bet a majority of the like 40% or so of those that didn't necessarily agree with that aren't saying, oh, Trump's going to help these things. It's just like they sucked before, they're going to suck now, whatever.
Right. But if you were to survey white Americans about this, we'd be in the 30s.
Well, they often 30s, do. 40s. They often do. Like,
right.
Like, how do you think Trump is going to affect the Black community, white person?
Right.
I think it'll be fine.
It'll
what
be
if they
all
got
right.
to
I
lose?
Mean, like 30% of us are in complete hysteria mode, but the rest of us are like, it'll probably be fine.
Yeah.
So I
just we're the
like
authority.
To say, right. Yeah, of course. Right. No, they may be the only rational demographic we have left in this country because they fully understand, according to the survey.
Right, and a wing of our party wants to tell them to go fuck themselves. Because
that they don't know their own best interest and...
Yeah. Who needs them, right?
Yeah.
Or they'll just vote with us no matter what.
Yep.
Who cares?
Yep.
Anyway,
okay.
We
got
to get to some politics for the last 15 minutes. Roy Moore won the special election
yes.
in Alabama.
Correct.
And most of the hyperventilating coverage was about how Trump endorsed the other guy. I don't care about that. Let's talk about who Roy Moore is.
Yep.
And this nightmare of a person who's coming to the United States Congress, most likely, if he wins the general election, which he probably will because it's fucking Alabama.
Right. So this is the guy, Jeff Sessions got plucked out of the Senate seat by Trump to be the attorney general.
Mm-hmm.
So this seat was open.
Yes.
That's why there was the special election.
Right.
And Roy Moore is a former Alabama Supreme Court justice. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Or was he just a judge?
I think he was a justice.
Yeah. He has a pretty long and sordid history of the fringiest of conservative evangelical politics, to the point where he was removed from his position
yeah.
because he refused to obey the court's order to allow same-sex marriage.
Right, George Wallace throwback type.
Yeah. Really the worst of the worst, the sort of scary... Like, I hate Jeff Sessions. I think he is a dangerous, racist, horrible man. This is like, Roy Moore is like Jeff Sessions on steroids.
And more overt.
And just completely, unabashedly racist, misogynistic, homophobic, Islamophobic. Yeah, I don't care about
the
rule of law because
the
Bible is the rule of law.
He's the guy that had the Ten Commandments put out in front of the court.
Yes, it was ordered to be removed and he refused.
Yeah, he's refused to honor the Supreme Court's same-sex marriage rulings.
Yep.
And this guy won the Republican primary and is very likely headed to the U.S. Senate.
Yes.
And our own Cory Gardner in Colorado, instead of tempering anything or saying he needs to respect, he said, can't wait to work with Roy Moore and advance conservative values. That's what
yep.
he said.
Yep.
So, and other senators said the same thing. They all basically kissed his ass.
Yeah.
With the exception of maybe Jeff Flake, one person, maybe I remember, like,
I don't
said
remember
he needs to respect the rule of law.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a weird thing to say since, you know, you're a legislator literally making the laws.
Sure.
It's very scary.
And granted, this guy hasn't won yet, and one poll came out that showed it might be close with the Democratic challenger, but he's going to win.
It's Alabama.
He's going to win.
Right.
I'm sorry.
And just to quickly touch on the media part of it, I'm really, really tired of this. Oh my God, it's a fight for the soul of the Republican Party from between Luther Strange and Roy Moore. What's the soul left if that's your choice? Crazy garbage person versus the worst person?
Yeah.
I mean, where is the soul? Yeah. I don't see it anymore.
Right.
And I'm not talking about like your dad's version of the Republican Party. That's gone.
Oh,
that died.
That's long gone.
Yeah. We're now talking about what exactly? Actually wanting to do something at all or just burn the building down?
Well, what we're talking about is that the reasonable people are Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and the people who just want to take away Roe versus Wade and take away your insurance and, you know,
that's as bad as it gets.
Just do all that stuff.
That's the soul.
Yeah.
I guess that's the soul. Yeah. And the people who literally want to electrocute me and rip the IUD out of my body and,
No. Even those are the reasonable ones.
Lynch.
Because that's Pence, and he's considered not as bad as Roy Moore. I mean, that's where we are now. It's just, we're going to just keep, you know, raising the bar on crazy until President Roy Moore's campaign in maybe 2020. I don't know. Why not? Yeah, we elected Trump. Why the fuck? Why wouldn't he run? If you're Roy Moore, why wouldn't you?
Why? Yeah, you just want a primary without the president's support.
Yeah.
Sure.
Why not?
Fuck it.
You know, you'll carry the South.
Yep. Makes Rick Santorum look mild.
There was a rumor that we're so short on time. Let's get into it. Tom Price resigned.
Yes.
Because he took a bunch of chartered flights on the
HHS
government's dime.
Secretary.
And he's not the only one. Pretty much everybody in Trump's cabinet is doing this. So I will see how
his were just particularly egregious. It was like almost $1 million in taxpayer money to fly to places like, I don't know, what was it? His son's something. And
it was a bunch of shit. Yeah.
There were definitely some like legitimate government things that he did, but there's absolutely
but he didn't have to fly charter
to
for those. He could have
charter a private jet to do that.
He could have flown commercial for like even first class for like $700,
right?
And instead
chartered a private jet on the taxpayer
$200,000 or something crazy like
correct
that. Crazy.
He's agreed to pay back $52,000 of the almost $1 million,
which are just his seats on these chartered flights. They're not the whole flights,
correct?
And he's not going to pay it back, obviously.
Well, yeah. So then he resigned the Friday afternoon.
Well, Trump made him resign.
Sure. He got fired. He resigned.
Yeah.
Whatever. So I'm going to read a list of the people who have currently been ousted that are at the top levels of the White House. This makes number 8, I want to say.
Yeah.
Michael Flynn, his National Security Advisor. Sean Spicer, his Press Secretary. Ranch Priebus. Former Chief of Staff. Scaramucci, Communications Director.
We
Steve
hardly
Bannon,
knew ya.
Chief Strategist. James Comey, FBI Director, and Sally Yates, Attorney General.
Yeah.
So he's got a pretty good track record. Now we have HHS Secretary out, and it's almost 10 months in.
But my point was there was rumors that Santorum was going to be named for new HHS, and I guess that didn't happen. He promoted somebody way down the chain and kind of raised people's eyebrows, but it doesn't matter because nothing matters
matter.
And nobody cares. And we got to move past that because there's other stuff to talk about.
Yeah, we got a lot.
Chip.
Yeah.
Expires tonight. It looks like they won't renew it. This is very important. This is a very, very popular children's health insurance program that they just were not able to get to refund because of their stupid Obamacare, Zombiecare repeal fight that never saw the light of day. And this is really, really, really going to very, very badly affect children, especially I think in Nevada and a few other states where they're very highly dependent on it. And this is a successful program. This has been a wildly popular program.
Yes.
This has been like Republicans now and then make.
Well, this is a Hillary program, right?
Yeah.
This is what she got instead of universal health care back in Hillary care
days. Right.
She got the children's health insurance program. So she said, all right, fuck it. You're not going to insure everybody. At least let's insure low-income children. We can fucking agree on that.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Every now and then, the Republicans have popped up and said, maybe we should get rid of this. And the blowback from the public and the media has been so fucking crazy that they've had to shut up. But now, with all the other chaos going on, it's like it's kind of under the radar, and I think they're going to try to get away with it. And it's
we just
be
want
really
children
bad.
To die. That's it.
Yeah,
I don't understand.
And you would think Dean Heller, who's in the fight of his life to try to get reelected, although he may have already conceded that he's fucked, would want to take the bull by the horns on this and try to get this through. But he's been pretty quiet. The governor of Nevada, I think, has maybe said a little. I mean, they've been so so involved in trying to repeal Obamacare that it's like they don't even like they can't even wrap their head around what needs to be done with this now.
I know.
So that is going.
So taking away health insurance from low-income children literally is.
And it may very well happen tonight.
I don't know what to say. I honest to God, you want to talk about, well, bootstraps and lazy people and whatever. I don't get wanting to let children
suffer.
I don't get it. I don't understand. I thought that was the one thing we could all agree on. These kids can't go to work. Like they need help. And if their family structure and situation doesn't allow for that, then that's our job.
Well,
as
this
society that exists for the betterment of, like, the social fucking contract.
Well, this is the frightening reality that we've encountered now, that the gerrymandering and the apathy during midterms of the other party's voting bloc has made it so that nothing really matters and they can basically get away with anything, it seems like.
But how many of these rural white working class voters in West Virginia have children that are on the CHIP program?
Tons, but all they listen to is radio and TV that says this is the fault of the brown people taking all your benefits.
This is the welfare queens in Detroit.
Yeah, yeah. That's why there's no money for this. And they believe it. There's no other good explanation for why they vote the way they do.
So, sorry your kid's gonna die, but...
Or they get mad about it and they say something, but then when it comes time to vote, they don't vote for the other party. Because they were Republicans. Whatever the fuck that means. Any event, so there's that. I know there's a bunch of other shit. What else we got quickly in the next few minutes? Tom Price is out. We got Chip.
North Korea.
Trump doesn't know what he's doing, and he thinks, like, tweeting a bunch of bellicose shit that he can't back up somehow is good.
North Korea apparently has been trying to court Republican strategists and people close to the Republican Party
to ask what the fuck's going on.
Ask literally to have a meeting to talk about what is Trump saying. Like, not what is he saying in terms of what, but what is his plan? Like, what is he doing?
Yeah,
they can't figure it out. They can literally quote his tweets from memory.
Yeah.
They have an encyclopedic knowledge of the way that our federal government works,
yeah,
including Congress.
Yeah.
But they would like to have meetings with Republican strategists to literally ask the question, what is he doing? Like, not the way that I ask it. Literally, what is the plan?
Yeah, because
what,
like,
does this mean? Is he actually going to bomb us?
Yeah.
Are we going to have a war? Like, we need to know what all of this Twitter things
mean. And they bring up the fact that he'll say one thing in the morning and then his spokespeople or his military people contradict him in the afternoon.
Yeah. And
like, what is going on?
What does that mean? Who should we be thinking
about?
And
the Republican strategists
have all said, no, we're not meeting with you. Except for they went to, like, New York and there was some UN thing and they met with some people and, like, diplomats, though,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
not like Republican strategists. And yeah. And they were like, these people are incredibly bright. Like, these North Koreans came over and literally, like, explained to us how Congress works, yeah, in a way that most Americans don't understand.
Well, most of these strategists know that, like, I mean, there's nothing that we're going to tell them that is in American interests, and they're not going to, they don't want to disarm or anything. So there's no reason to, but.
And it looks bad for my public persona.
Oh yeah. 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 It looks
terrible.
And I
can't get the next, you know, job as a strategist for the next person who's going to run
next
or whatever.
Think tank or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can't put that on your resume.
Right.
But in any event, yeah, it's like they just, and I'm pretty sure if the strategist would return their calls, they'd go, I don't know.
I have no idea. We don't have foreign policy now.
Yeah.
We have tweets. We know as much as you know,
yeah,
which is we have tweets.
Yeah.
So we can talk about the tweets and your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah.
I know the general, but I don't really know how much power he has, so I don't really have anything to tell you.
And then
you,
Trump and his apologists would say, like, well, this is by design. Keep them guessing.
Keep them guessing. Keep them. No.
That's really dangerous.
Yeah.
Because if they feel like...
What if they guess wrong?
Yeah. What if they feel, like, boxed in and they decide, shit, we're going to get invaded. We're going to get bombed. We better hit the South Koreans.
Or Japan.
And
try to figure out a way to hit the goddamn states already.
No, I don't think they'd go that far. I don't think they feel they need to. But if they can knock out the capability of South Korea to invade in Japan, then they
or
might
knock out some then they might U.S. military bases
right
in South
and then
Korea
they might
and
gamble that the people of the United States just don't want a bunch of troops on North Korean soil where every man, woman, and child would be armed to the hilt, and it would be a horrible war of attrition in which hundreds and thousands of American personnel would die. I mean, like, these are the risks we're facing here.
Yes.
I'm not saying that's a likely scenario, but if it's a possible scenario.
I don't know what's likely.
If you're North Korean leadership and you don't know what's going on and you assume the worst, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
This is not a game anymore, people. This is not a game. Your feel-good vote because you were pissed off at the DNC or Make America Great Again was the slogan that made you feel good. It's like, these are real-world stakes now.
Yes.
And we're facing potential catastrophes. And, you know, maybe some smarter people will eventually get in the room with the right North Korean people and at least calm things down to where we don't stumble into war that nobody wants. The North Koreans don't want war. It doesn't matter whatever bullshit, bellicose bullshit they spew.
No, of course they don't. They don't want to look weak either.
No.
They don't want to look like we can't handle you.
No.
And they're not going to they're not going to allow themselves to be perceived that way.
Look, the rat that gets cornered and stands on its hind legs and spits at you doesn't want to get in a fight with you.
No, it wants you to go away.
But eventually, if it thinks this...
All right, you're going to kill me.
I'm
going to attack.
I'm going to dig my fucking rat teeth into your neck.
Yeah, I'm going to scratch at your soft belly.
Yeah.
Because that's the only fucking choice
I have.
But I might die, but I'm taking you out with me.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what else to do.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And Trump is literally too stupid to understand that scenario.
He's not stupid. He doesn't care.
Well, he'll survive.
He doesn't care. Does not matter to him at all because it's not about him.
It will be. But.
Yeah.
Good God. Anyway, so not to scare you with that, but I'm not saying it's likely we're going to war with North Korea. I'm just saying it's way more likely than it was before this imbecile is in office.
Yep. We sure wouldn't be in this place if those emails, you know?
Oh, God. I can't.
I know.
So what else we got? I mean, there's more shit, too. There's the fact that it's not just Price that took all these chartered flights. Mnuchin did it, and Ryan Zinke did it, and everybody in Trump's cabinet essentially has been violating the government and the taxpayers for money to live high on the hog.
Yep.
Because they
think
they can.
They have this perception that no one's going to notice, right?
Yeah.
They have this perception of like, oh, government waste and this conservative ideology about how government spends money. So when they got into government, I think they all thought like, we can do whatever we want because that's what government does. And they don't realize that actually that's a bullshit Republican conservative thing to say. And
well, they also think they're entitled
there's
to
a lot. But hold on. But there's a lot of transparency and reporting and shit that's required when you're in government that they seem to not mention. And I think they maybe didn't know. And I think it surprised everyone. They were like, holy shit, they keep track of that. What about all this government waste I keep hearing about? And you're like, no, that you made that up, right? You made that up. That's not really a thing. And yes, of course we fucking keep track of that. And here's the report and you're fired. And they were like, whoa, I literally had no idea.
Oh, well, only one has been fired to this point.
Yeah, but I mean, I really think it's taken them all by surprise. They're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Okay. Guess we can't do that anymore.
And then there's Kushner, more and more revelations about shit he left out on his disclosure. He's also registered as a woman to vote in New York.
That got cleared up. That was
it's a typo.
Yeah.
It's just
he's
funny.
Also using private emails as
that's right. Private emails.
Everybody's been using private emails.
Yeah, remember that was a thing that we were supposed to really, really care about? And I want to point this out, right? Because some of the apologists, especially like New York Times and other places, have said like...
There is no equivalency, right?
No, but it's actually kind of worse. Because Hillary put all her business on this private server that she created for the State Department.
That the foundation had in the home that was incredibly secure because hundreds of millions of dollars passed through the foundation.
Well, that's not just it. The point is that like it's all in one place and you know where to find it when you run the audit trail. And there's the argument about the ones she had a discretion to delete, which conservatives think are all the Benghazi Pizzagate smoking gun emails.
Right.
But that's not the point. The point is, to me, it looks much more fishy. If you have an official White House email and a private email, then it's like, oh, so it's like having a burner phone when you're married. like, it's like, oh, so we're keeping the shady shit.
Well, and on not this only one. That, the other part of it that makes me crazy is Hillary didn't think she was doing anything wrong.
Right.
They ran on her emails and then fucking did it.
Right.
So they knew. It's not like she was like, I shouldn't have done that. I didn't know. Everyone does that. Yeah. They were like, literally ran a campaign and beat her on her emails and then did the exact same thing she did.
Yeah, because they, well, why, you know what? Why do you think, that, and we're just about out of time here, but I'll just leave it with this. Like, why do you think that Price and Zinke and Ivanka never think they could get away with this? Because you went in violating all these emoluments and everything else, and nobody lifted a finger, and nobody cared, and the media looked the other way, and Congress doesn't care. So why the fuck not? Take all the charter jets, make all the private emails. It's nothing matters. Nothing There's matters. No accountability. Yep. Now there might be, and people are surprised. It's a clusterfuck.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it. We're out of time.
Okay.
We covered a lot of ground today. We're going to cover more, obviously, next week. Reverent Duo on Twitter, reverenttestimony@gmail.com, patreon.com/irreverenttestimony, and that's it. Any other closing thoughts, arguments?
Okay. Stay tuned, stay active, stay engaged.
Stay involved, all those things.
Yep.
Adios.